Cass County Lakes has a presentation with loon biologist Dr. Walter Piper Saturday, July 12th at 1 p.m. at Salem Lutheran Church in Longville. The Minnesota Board of Water and Soil Resources offers the Lawns to Legumes program, which aims to increase habitat for at-risk pollinators in residential settings. The deadline to apply for the 2026 season is November 30th. Find more info and apply at bluethumb.org. The McCroskey Art Center presents its annual Downtown Art Fair Saturday, July 12th from 9 to 4 on the grounds of Old Central School in Grand Rapids, with over 40 regional artists, food vendors, hands-on activities, and live music. The Park Rapids Water Ski Team performs Saturday, July 12th at 6 p.m. at Halverson Beach in Nevis. Bring your own chair or beach towel. Now we'll take you back to Morning Edition here on member-supported KAXE-KBXE.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. The House is wrapping up debate on the massive tax cut and spending bill backed by President Trump. Lawmakers in the House spent all night deciding whether to advance the bill in a procedural vote. House Republican leaders, along with the president, managed to get a few key holdouts to agree. The procedural vote passed narrowly. Speaker Mike Johnson believes the tax cut and spending legislation will finally be passed by the House this morning.
We're going to deliver the big, beautiful bill, the president's America First agenda, and we're going to do right by the American people. This is going to be a great thing for the country. Look forward to moving it forward.
But Democratic leader Hakeem Jeffries is expressing his anger over the bill, saying it will harm the most vulnerable Americans.
This disgusting abomination, the GOP tax scam that guts Medicaid, rips food from the mouths of children, seniors, and veterans, and rewards billionaires with massive tax breaks.
If the bill passes the House, it will go to President Trump for his signature. The Labor Department delivers its monthly snapshot on the job market this morning. NPR Scott Horsley reports the news comes a day early this month because of the July 4th holiday.
There have been some mixed signals about the strength of the job market this week. A government report showed an uptick in the number of job openings, but an analysis from payroll processor ADP showed an unexpected drop in private sector employment last month. Forecasters expect today's report to show a modest slowdown in June hiring, with employers adding somewhere around 100,000 jobs. The Federal Reserve is on the lookout for any weakness in the job market, which could make a cut in interest rates more likely. Economists will also be watching what happened to the workforce in June after more than 600,000 people dropped out of the labor force the previous month. Scott Horsley, NPR News, Washington.
Hospital officials in Gaza report more than 80 Palestinians have been killed by Israeli fire overnight. This is as Israel intensifies its offensive in the enclave. That's as Hamas says it is studying a proposal for new ceasefire talks with Israel. As NPR's Daniel Estrin reports, Israel says it wants high-level talks soon.
Officials from both Hamas and Israel say there are positive signs that both sides are ready to negotiate a ceasefire in Gaza. Israel's foreign minister said Israel wants talks as soon as possible. A person briefed on the matter, not authorized to speak about it publicly, said Israel has agreed to a 60-day ceasefire, with Hamas releasing around half of the living and dead hostages it's holding, and Israel releasing Palestinian prisoners. There would also be U.S. guarantees that during the ceasefire, the sides would discuss a final end to the war. It could take weeks of talks before a ceasefire begins. In the meantime, Israel's military is intensifying deadly strikes in Gaza. Daniel Estrin, NPR News, Tel Aviv.
On Wall Street, in pre-market trading, Dow futures are higher. This is NPR. President Trump visits Des Moines, Iowa today. He's kicking off celebrations to mark a year before the 250th anniversary of the signing of the Declaration of Independence. Organizers have planned festivities over the next 12 months. The final celebration is planned for next year on the National Mall in Washington, D.C. The pop charts have not changed much lately, but a superstar rapper is making her presence felt this week. NPR's Stephen Thompson has the story.
Alex Warren's Ordinary is the number one song for a fourth week, part of a larger pattern where hit songs tend to sit on the chart for ages. But this week, the rapper Cardi B is shaking off the chart doldrums. Her new song, Outside, debuts at number 10. Cardi B has released a bunch of freestanding hit singles since her last album in 2018, and several of them, including Up and WAP, will appear on her forthcoming album, Am I the Drama? Cardi B has already pulled off an odd feat by including hits from 4 or 5 years ago. Am I the Drama has already qualified for platinum status, and it's not even out until September. Stephen Thompson, NPR News.
The canned food company Del Monte is filing for federal bankruptcy protection. Del Monte is expected to sell off many of its assets. Some observers say consumers have been focused more recently on fresh foods as opposed to canned goods. It'll be hot in the upper Midwest today. In parts of northern Minnesota and Wisconsin, it could feel like it's 100 degrees or more today. I'm Corva Coleman, NPR News, from Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include AG1, introducing AG1 Next Gen, a daily drink with vitamins, minerals, and probiotics to support overall health. Learn more at drinkag1.com/science.
I now look back at that and there's guilt.
This is Beyond Active Duty, Caring for Those Who Served, a series exploring the challenges Minnesota's veterans face, as well as the opportunities and services available to them.
My name is Major General Retired Joanna Clyborn, and I served in the Minnesota National Guard and in the military for the last 35 years. I had a member of my team commit suicide in Iraq. I saw no warning signs. I saw no indication at all that that was the route that they were heading to, only to be awoken 24 hours later that the individual had in fact killed themselves. A lot of people walk amongst us. The term actually was referred to as high-functioning PTSD. They don't have the traditional telltale signs of depression or of any of the post-traumatic stress syndrome type of signs that you see. They're high functioning within society, but they're struggling. And they're not open about the struggle, and you can't see the struggle because everything looks great.
Beyond Active Duty, Caring for Those Who Served is produced by AMPERS with support from the Minnesota Department of Veterans Affairs, providing our veterans with help. Veterans can find that help online at minnesotaveteran.org.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. Ami Martinez in Los Angeles, California.
And I'm Leila Faudel in Washington. After a nearly day-long stalemate that stretched into the early morning hours, House Republicans cleared a key hurdle for President Trump's massive tax and spending package.
A group of GOP holdouts stalled a procedural vote for a while, but ultimately enough gave in to move the bill forward. Now Republicans are racing to approve the plan in time to get the bill to President Trump's desk by tomorrow's self-imposed July 4th deadline.
NPR congressional correspondent Claudia Grisales has been following all this and joins us now. Hi, Claudia.
Hi, Leila.
So the Republican-led House wanted to get this done yesterday, but there were holdouts and discussions with them stretched through the night. How did the Republicans get this done?
Right. We've seen this movie a few times.
Yeah.
And so what we've seen and saw again last night is fiscal hawks and moderates opposed to the bill's Senate changes after it passed there earlier in the week. Moderates, for example, have been concerned about steeper cuts to Medicaid, which provides health care for low-income, elderly, and disabled Americans. Well, fiscal hawks said the cuts didn't go deep enough. So this vote series was kept open since yesterday morning as these talks with the holdouts and House Republican leaders continued. And we even saw some of this play out on the House floor right after a member of the fiscally conservative House Freedom Caucus. This is Congressman Andrew Clyde of Georgia voted no. We saw him immediately surrounded by leadership, followed by an extended one-on-one with House Speaker Mike Johnson. But the paralysis finally broke this morning after Clyde and several other no's flipped to yes. And remember, these are tightly held chambers and Johnson can only afford to lose 3 votes.
Did the holdouts get what they wanted?
Well, we're still learning the specifics of what Republican leaders agreed to do in order to sway them to yes. But what we do know is that for hours, more than half a dozen holdouts withheld their votes, and at least 4, at times 5 members, too many for Johnson's tight margins in the House, were no's. So some of these holdouts wanted material changes to the bill, but Republican leaders argued it's too late in the process. So it's possible promises on future bills were made, but we'll have to wait and see.
Now, Claudia, I know you've been reporting on this on the air with us for a long time now, but just remind us what's in this bill and what made it so contentious.
Right, right. At the heart of the legislation is an extension of President Trump's 2017 tax cut program. It also ends taxes on tips and overtime, at least temporarily, which was a Trump campaign promise. The bill also includes new spending on defense and immigration enforcement, and it lifts the nation's debt ceiling by $5 trillion, and that's key because the debt ceiling will be hit this summer. Now, to pay for all that, the bill cuts spending across a range of programs, most notably Medicaid. This is the joint federal and state program for roughly 70 million Americans. Now around 11 million could lose their coverage, making this a very contentious fight.
The Democrats, as we know, oppose the passage of this bill, and they've been very vocal about that. But is there anything they can do?
Right. The most they can really do is just stall the process. And that's what they're doing right now. House Democratic Leader Hakeem Jeffries is extending his speech for as long as possible to hold up this final vote. But for Republicans to get past that procedural vote was a huge hurdle. It could signal that the finish line is in sight. And it could take a few more hours, but assuming they have the votes, Republicans could make good on their promises to deliver this to Trump's desk by July 4th. But we should note the fight is not over. Democrats will make this bill the centerpiece of their campaign to win back Congress in the next year.
That is NPR's Claudia Grisales. Thank you, Claudia.
Thank you.
For more on the bill and how Republicans are working to get it over the finish line, we're joined now by Republican strategist Brendan Buck. He's a partner in the consulting firm Seven Letter, previously a top staff member with two former House speakers, Paul Ryan and John Boehner. So, Brendan, we saw several Republicans switching their votes from no to yes during a procedural vote in the wee overnight hours. What do you think got them to change their vote?
Maybe just the reality that they understood this was bill is not going to change, and they were really only prolonging the inevitable here. Of course, Donald Trump also weighing in and his staff putting pressure on them, I'm sure, helped a little bit. But there was really nowhere else to go for some of these members. The Senate bill was not going to change. They have this deadline, and there were a really small number of these folks who were wanting to vote no. And I think eventually this, or the walls just sort of closed in on them.
You mentioned the deadline, this July 4th deadline that the president has hung over all this. What do you make of this? Because Kentucky Congressman Thomas Massie insists it's arbitrary, but it kind of feels like a hard deadline to everyone else, I think.
Look, Congress doesn't do a lot of things without a deadline. And I actually credit Speaker Mike Johnson with setting this deadline, basically saying, here's when we're going to get it done. And a lot of people doubted him, said, A, one, it's arbitrary, or two, it's just not realistic. But he used that really effectively, and I think that increased the pressure. And this was all about a pressure campaign. A lot of people didn't want to vote for this, but whether it was to support Donald Trump or to finally just get this done with and over, he put maximum pressure on them. And I think the deadline actually served them very, very well.
Considering your experience working with GOP House speakers, where do you think Mike Johnson's head is right now? Because he's on the verge of a pretty major victory, one that can give him a nice feather in his cap that I don't know how much Donald Trump will care about that feather in his cap, but it's one that he can show.
Yeah, let's set aside the substance of the bill. As a matter of marshaling legislation through Congress, I think we should now have a lot of respect for Mike Johnson's abilities. This is a member of Congress who's not been around for very long. He was put into the speakership after only a few terms, and he has proven very adept at this, not only setting those deadlines, but also just having a way with members where they never feel like they're being pressured too much, but always end up coming around. Now, look, we can't overlook the Donald Trump factor. That is, of course, what is driving a lot of this. But time and time again, he has gone to the floor unclear if they're going to have the votes to pass something. And every single time he's delivered. And I think that will give him a lot of credibility going forward. And it seems like he's got a pretty firm grip over the job at this point.
Hakeem Jeffries is still speaking right now. How quickly, as soon as he finishes, will you think Johnson will call this vote?
Oh, I think very quickly. And they only allowed for a total hour of one debate. Of course, Hakeem Jeffries speaking doesn't count towards that. But I think they're ready to get this done. I think they're ready to get out of town. That's also another factor here. I think these members of Congress are people. They have families. They want to get home. So I think they're going to vote very quickly. Whether or not that vote takes as long as the last ones, hopefully not. I imagine they have the votes wrapped up at this point, but this could be all said and done by this morning.
An hour of debate. What's there to debate at this point? Do you think there's actually any room for drama here?
I don't know that there's drama, but I'm still very interested to see how the vote goes. Republicans can only lose 3 votes. 4 would defeat the bill. And there's definitely going to be a number of members, particularly those moderate members or members in swing states, who don't want to have to vote for this. It would probably imperil their reelection. So I think they're going to limit the defections to 3, but it will be interesting to see who those 3 are and whether there's any sort of standoff of who gets to vote no.
How much do you think President Trump cares about how the bill may play out in the 2026 midterms?
This has been a president remarkably disengaged from this process. You know, I've been through many legislative battles where you have presidents who, you know, they and their staff are very closely involved. And this president had a very hands-off approach. You recall there was a debate about one bill versus 2 bills, and he didn't really care. And he's talked about whether we're doing Medicaid or not, and sort of took both sides of that issue. I think he likes having a win. And that's ultimately what this came down to. I mean, the argument being made to a lot of Republicans to vote for it at this point is not, hey, this is a great bill. It's, we need to give Donald Trump this win. I think that's a terrible way to look at your job as a policymaker, but it's probably going to carry the day here.
A win for Donald Trump today, but will it be a win for the Republican Party later? Because Democrats are going to position themselves to run on this bill in the midterms.
Absolutely. And I think one of the huge problems Republicans have at this point was this started off as an extension of the 2017 tax law and ended up becoming defined as a healthcare debate. The Medicaid changes that they have made, I think, are going to be really significant both to people's lives, but also politically. And it's a shame because this was the healthcare policy here was really just done as an offset. They were trying to find some savings. It wasn't done as a way to improve people's health. So that leaves them very vulnerable, and a lot of members are going to have to answer for why they voted for something that could potentially cut millions of people from their coverage.
That's Republican strategist Brendan Buck. He's a partner at the consulting firm 7Letter. Brendan, thanks.
Thank you.
In a hastily scheduled hearing yesterday, a former criminology graduate student pleaded guilty to murdering 4 University of Idaho students. Lauren Patterson with Northwest Public Broadcasting was in the courtroom.
In the early morning hours of November 13th, 3 years ago, 4 University of Idaho students were stabbed to death by someone who broke into an off-campus house. The crime shocked the small, normally quiet college town of Moscow, Idaho, as police gathered evidence and hunted for a suspect. More than a month later, they arrested 28-year-old Brian Koberger in Pennsylvania at his parents' home. Koberger maintained his innocence, claiming he was out for a drive at the time of the murders. Prosecutors said they found DNA evidence on a knife sheath tying him to the scene.
We are here today to entertain a change of plea.
Yesterday, the families of the victims, reporters, and police packed a courtroom for a hearing that was scheduled just one day before. Judge Stephen Hippler addressed Koberger.
Are you pleading guilty because you are guilty?
Yes.
Koberger admitted to killing all 4 students who were 20 and 21 years old. In order to avoid a potential death sentence, he accepted a plea of consecutive life terms for the murders of Madison Mogan, Kaylee Gonzalez, Zana Kernodal, and Ethan Chapin, waiving his right to appeal. The reactions of the victims' families to the deal prosecutors offered were mixed.
You didn't give us the common courtesy to negotiate with us.
Steve Gonzalez, father of Kaylee Gonzalez, was upset prosecutor Bill Thompson did not involve his family in the decision.
He only negotiated with the murderer of our children. That was the only person that he negotiated.
But family members of students Mogan and Chapin said Tuesday that they support the plea deal. Brian Koberger, now 30, is being held in the Ada County, Idaho jail. His sentencing hearing is scheduled for July 23rd. For NPR News, I'm Lauren Patterson in Boise.
This is NPR News.
On the next Fresh Air, life as a failed child star. We talk with Tamara Yahia about growing up in Argentina, at 11 performing an imitation of Madonna, becoming a popular singer and dancer, and later realizing she was sexualized as a child. In her memoir, she also writes about immigrating with her family to California and nearly getting deported. Join us.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Fisher Investments. Fisher's dedicated team of specialists provide resources on investing, retirement income, estate planning, and more. Learn more at fisherinvestments.com. Investing in securities involves the risk of loss. From Procter & Gamble, maker of ZzzQuil, with a range of products designed to relieve occasional sleeplessness to help people fall asleep. Learn more at ZzzQuil.com. From the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, supporting creative people and effective institutions committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. More information is at macfound.org. And from the Skoll Foundation, dedicated to powering social innovators to transform the world. Learn more at skoll.org.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Amy Martinez.
And I'm Leila Faldel. Through fragments of history, memory, grief, and hope, author and psychologist Hala Elian braids together the story of her life and the start of another. The memoir is called I'll Tell You When I'm Home. In it, Elian writes of the exile of her Palestinian ancestors and her family's life of repeated displacement through force or war from Gaza, from Kuwait, from Lebanon. Her search for home is framed through Elian's struggle to get pregnant, the many miscarriages, and then a new life through surrogacy, a baby named Leila. Hala Elian joins me now. Thank you for coming back on the program.
Thank you so much for having me.
Why were you taking stock in this moment and deciding to write the story of a life, your life?
Because I felt like my life was untenable, as it was. Because I felt like I had been sleepwalking for several years and then looked around and saw that I was in the midst of infertility, in the midst of several miscarriages, that I was longing and longing for an experience that I wasn't sure was going to come. The pandemic had started, and I was somebody who had at that point done kind of what I thought were all the correct things, quote unquote. You know, I had gotten sober many years earlier. I had tackled an eating disorder. I dealt with, you know, different traumas that I had. I was, you know, successful by metrics of, I taught, I was writing, I was doing all these different things. I had a private practice. And there was just, and I just could not separate what was happening in my life with what was happening in these places that I belong to and that I came from.
Your book, as you point out, is really this journey, trying to get pregnant, the many miscarriages, the pain of being angry at your body, and the ultimate decision that you make almost recklessly one night to seek surrogacy. Just talk to me about that moment you made the decision.
Yeah, I had just done the DNC, which is a procedure to essentially take care of pregnancies that are not going to be able to continue, for the final miscarriage, which was the hardest because it was the one where there had been a heartbeat and I'd heard it and it was okay. And then it started to slow and then there was no heartbeat. I come home and I was still, you know, like I had just done anesthesia. I was like kind of groggy and whatever. And just before I could even really think, I'm in process of what I was doing, I emailed. So I had contacted a surrogacy agency months earlier and I just wrote them and was like, I'm ready to go.
What was it like for you not to carry yourself? I mean, you write a lot about your body and this journey.
I began the surrogacy process. And then as the months went on, I started to understand the implications. So meaning like, you know, the first time the baby moved, to be like, oh, I'm hearing a description of this, right? I'm hearing the heartbeat through the phone. I'm hearing about the baby moving. I'm hearing about the cravings. I think pregnancy notoriously is like a period of waiting and taking stock. But in my case, it was waiting for something to happen in someone else's body.
Mm-hmm.
And that tension started to really echo for me a lot of the metaphors of like exile and displacement and what it felt to be kind of, yeah, to be a little bit locked out of the experience while also being kind of breathlessly grateful that it was still happening.
You call the book I'll Tell You When I'm Home. The title, where did it come from, and did you ever get home?
You know, I think motherhood has felt very much like a kind of home for me. And I've been very grateful for that because, you know, I wanted very badly to be a mother, but wanting something is not a guarantee that you'll enjoy it or you'll love it. It's one of the under-discussed things about the human experience. And so I feel particularly grateful that when it arrived, I have loved it. I mean, maybe it's because I'm also solo parenting, but I think there is a profound way in which I feel like I am day-to-day, like, architecting this with this little human.
And you end the book with Layla's birth. Tell me what that was like.
I had rehearsed also in my mind for years the moment of birthing. You know, I don't know that I would say I was looking forward to it, but I had certainly thought of, like, what it would be like, you know, to feel, to have to face that. And then to be like, oh, in all my rehearsal of life looking one way, this is one of the few times that it never even occurred to me to rehearse this. And like, nothing is more beautiful than to show up to your life unrehearsed. And that's exactly what that moment was.
Nothing is more beautiful than to show up in your life unrehearsed. I love that. There is a passage near the end of your book on page 252. Do you mind reading that passage?
In you is the story of sailors, occupiers, the occupied, the people who never left, the people who were made to. You will learn to live within this, as we all do. You come from people that love the way moons pull tides, or else the way that tides are pulled by the moon, and someday you will have to reckon with your own unruly heart. I have no advice to give, save one thing. Don't exile anything. Turn the sun of your attention briefly, sometimes briefly, on all that awakens your love. This is your birthright, Layla. You will have to hunt for many things, excavate them in others or yourself, but not your mother's truth. I'll leave that right in the open for you to see.
You're a few years into parenting.
Yeah, three.
How would you describe the mother you are?
You know, shockingly, like, laid back, actually. I have a very close friend that was like, she's like, you might be the most, like, calm and unanxious parent I've seen. You know, when you pursue something like surrogacy, there is maybe no greater act than trust. By the time she came into the world, I had to practice that muscle. And so I feel more trusting now of the world than I did before her.
Hannah Alian's latest book is a memoir. It's called I'll Tell You When I'm Home. Thank you so much, and congratulations on your book.
Thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate it.
This is NPR News.
Author Honoré Fanon-Jeffers has written fiction, but when she decided to trace the stories of her own family, she was worried.
I was really afraid that people would feel like I was betraying my parents, and in particular, my mother.
I'm Juana Summers. My conversation with Jeffers about her new collection on All Things Considered from NPR News.
And you can hear All Things Considered later today at 4 o'clock here on member-supported KAXE, KBXE. You're listening to the Wednesday Morning Show. I'm Andrew.
Wait a minute. Andrew.
What?
It's not Wednesday.
What?
It's not Wednesday.
Oh, it has to be because I'm hosting the morning show with you.
No, it's Thursday.
What?
It's Thursday.
It's Thursday? You're telling me it's the Thursday morning show?
It's the Thursday morning show at KBXE.
What?
I know.
Oh, my gosh.
I know.
Oh, my gosh. What are we going to do?
I'm not sure. Are you having some deja vu?
Yes. It feels like I just did this.
It's a puzzle.
All right. Well, I guess it's the Thursday morning show. I'm your host, Andrew. I'm still Andrew DeZingle, right?
I think so, unless I am.
And you're
You're Heather Johnson.
Pretty sure.
Okay. Well, at least we got that cleared up. And we're here until 9 o'clock, and then we're going to hand things over to, I guess, DJ Dang
for Headwaters. Hey, this is a great day.
It is July 3rd, and we've got quite the show planned for you today. We're going to be talking to Eli Sager, talking about good forestry techniques after a storm. And we're also going to be talking to Katie Marshall for the McCrosty Art Center about the First Thursday. Yes.
Oh, everything is kind of upside down this week.
Yes, this is because of the holiday tomorrow. Some things have been flipped around.
That happens.
So, but also later in the show, we're going to be taking your phone calls. That's right. You get to appear on the Thursday morning show just like us.
Yeah, exactly. Live, call in. Do we want to reveal what we'll be talking about?
Yeah, let's get people start talking right now. So we want to make the perfect barbecue playlist. We know a lot of people are probably going to be barbecuing this weekend. Yeah. What songs must be on the playlist for a nice backyard vibe? We want to hear from you. If you want to text us right now, you can at 218-326-1234. Let's get this playlist going. Heather, can you think of something right off the top of your head that you would add?
For the summer playlist? Well, you have to have...
Barbecue playlist.
Barbecue playlist. You got to have the Come On Over to My House, the jazz song, right?
How's that go?
I'm not going to sing it. Oh, no, everybody eats when they come to my house.
Oh, okay.
Cab Calloway?
Okay.
Maybe the originator?
What would I add? I would add Bright Whites by Kishi Bashi.
Oh, of course. Everyone would add that.
That's such a fun song. And maybe we'll hear it later today.
Hey, that would be cool.
That'd be fun. And of course, we'll be hearing from you later today. But programming on KAXE, KBXE is supported in part by the Bush Foundation, investing in great ideas and the people who power them, introducing the 2025 Bush Fellows, leaders working to make the region better for everyone. More information is online at bushfoundation.org.
Programming on KAXE, KBXE is supported in part by the Minnesota Board on Aging's Legal Kiosks, offering no charge assistance with housing benefits, custody, and more. Legal Kiosks, located in libraries and trusted local community spaces, connect Minnesotans with legal information and virtual meeting access. In some locations, court forms can be printed at no cost. Help is available in many languages. More online at legalkiosks.org.
And looking at weather today, sunny skies, highs near 88 degrees, slight chance of showers, southeast winds 5 to 10 miles per hour. Tonight, also slight chance of showers and thunderstorms, partly cloudy, lows around 70. Tomorrow, though, 50% chance of showers and thunderstorms in the afternoon. Otherwise, it should be mostly sunny, highs in the low 90s, southeast winds 10 to 15 miles per hour. Good chance for showers and thunderstorms at night, though.
Boo! That's
so
when the
might not
fireworks.
Be great fireworks weather tomorrow night.
Well, lucky for Bemidji, Bemidji had their fireworks last night.
Yes, and I, of course, as a good boy, was already in bed while it was happening, and
good
I
job.
Thought the noise was my neighbor moving furniture.
Really?
Yeah. It was like, doo-doo-doo-doo. I was like, what are they doing over there?
Does he normally move furniture with like small blasts of TNT?
Sometimes somebody hammers nearby me.
I know it's not you because you don't have a hammer.
I have a hammer.
Oh, that's right.
Did I not send you guys a picture of me having a hammer?
I don't have that picture.
Oh, maybe I need to.
Everyone needs to see this picture. Everyone does.
It's a really good hammer. It's red and everything.
It's red. There's so many details I didn't know about. Oh, my goodness.
So let's hear from you. Text us 218-326-1234. What should be on our summer barbecue playlist? We want to hear from you. Now it's time for National Native News.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. With Alaska U.S. Senator Lisa Murkowski's help, Senate Republicans passed a sprawling budget reconciliation bill that contains much of President Trump's domestic policy agenda. Alaska tribes and Native organizations have raised concerns about the bill. The Tlingit and Haida Indian tribes recently sent a letter to Alaska's congressional delegation opposing the bill with concerns about clean energy, food security, healthcare, and lands and forests. In a statement Monday, the Fairbanks Native Association said it's deeply troubled by the passage of the spending bill, raising concerns about funding cuts to tribes, which provide critical services, including healthcare and food assistance. Murkowski said it was one of the hardest votes she's ever taken, and she's hoping it will be changed further before Congress sends it to the president's desk. She said she helped improve the bill for Alaska, but she said in an emailed statement, quote, "It is not good enough for the rest of our nation, and we all know it," end quote. The bill's passage followed intense negotiations between Murkowski and Senate leaders, aimed at retooling the bill to overcome her objections to removing benefits from Alaskans on Medicaid and food assistance. Murkowski said she decided to vote yes because Republicans made adequate changes to rural health care and food assistance. She cited a $50 billion fund for rural hospitals and clinics and added flexibility for Alaska in administering changes to SNAP. Only three Senate Republicans joined Democrats in voting against the bill. Alaska U.S. Senator Dan Sullivan voted yes. The bill includes new oil lease sales in the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge and the National Petroleum Reserve, Alaska. Murkowski has championed those for years. The bill goes to the House, where a different version passed in May without a vote to spare. Any changes would have to be approved again in the Senate. The Miccosukee tribe in Florida is opposing the Trump administration's new immigration facility at an airstrip in the Everglades, which the administration calls Alligator Alcatraz. Chairman Talbert Cypress told ABC News that the tribe held a meeting this week regarding the facility, which is located on tribal traditional homelands of Miccosukee and Seminole people.
The tribe has been at home in the Big Cypress for centuries. And what was decided at the meeting was to, examine all avenues that we have to temporarily delay this facility.
Cypress says the tribe's concerned about any potential environmental impacts and safety concerns for tribal members. Demonstrators have reportedly been in the area opposing the facility, as President Trump was given a guided tour on Tuesday. The administration is touting the area for its remote location and surrounding wildlife as barriers for people to escape. Native Americans in Washington state face opioid and fentanyl overdose rates four times the national average. Isabel Charlet has more.
Leaders are calling for more investment in treatment centers and transitional housing to address the problem. While nationally fentanyl overdoses have declined, Native American fatalities have surged since the pandemic. Representative Deborah Lekanoff is part of the State Tribal Opioid Fentanyl Task Force. During the task force's third annual summit, tribal leaders and state agencies met for 3 days and heard from community members in recovery from opioid use disorder. Last year, says Lekanoff, the task force partnered with tribal governments and invested in substance abuse treatment facilities based on a successful model created by the Swinomish.
The model that Swinomish created 12 years ago has now been incorporated into over 20 tribally owned substance abuse disorder facilities that are healing all Washingtonians.
Lekanoff says in the next couple of years, the task force will focus on transitional housing for those recovering from substance abuse. She says this is a nonpartisan issue and it will take everyone working together to make change. I'm Isabel Sharp.
And I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
National Native News is produced by Kohonic Broadcast Corporation, funded by the Annenberg Foundation, the Ford Foundation, and the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Coming up next, we're going to be hearing more from Morning Edition, talking about Alabama Food Bank founder, and ghost guns are back. We'll be talking about that in just a bit. I'm Andrew Zingel, here with Heather Johnson, and we are looking for your summer barbecue music playlist. And we got a text on the text line. Heather, who did we hear from?
We heard from senior correspondent Scott Hall. His song pick is Struttin' with Some Barbecue by Louis Armstrong, who, to my knowledge, has never been to the moon.
You know, I just watched a movie recently with Louis Armstrong in it.
Oh, which one?
Called Paris Blues, starring Paul Newman and Sidney Poitier.
Whoa, that sounds amazing.
And who was married to Paul Newman?
Oh, goodness.
I can't remember her name.
I'm not good at this game.
Well, anyway, she's also in the movie, and I wonder if that's how they met.
It could be. I need to watch that. That sounds
It was on Tubi, amazing? I believe.
What would we do without Tubi, us classic movie lovers?
Tubi
seriously.
Or not Tubi?
Exactly.
Are these movies on there?
Thank you, Scott Hall, and good morning.
Thank you. And we want to hear from you. What do you want to hear on a summer barbecue playlist? Text 218-326-1234. Around 8:05, we're going to be taking your phone calls to talk about what songs we need to have on the playlist.
Yeah.
And we're excited to hear from you.
Yeah, what genre are you thinking of when you think of summer barbecue? What's the first thing that pops into your head?
Genre wise, I don't know.
Really?
Yeah, because I'm just thinking like any like uplifting, happy songs.
Oh, absolutely, uplifting and happy is a good way to go. I immediately go to classic rock.
Oh,
which is weird because that's not what I picked. But you know, that's just like that's the summer thing.
Would you say it's classic rock that really rocks?
No, that's something else. It might really rock, or it might be super stale. I don't know.
So also on the barbecue playlist, you know, you got to have some of the groovy ones too.
Yeah, that's true. Yep. Like what?
Like In the Groove by Madonna. I wouldn't mind that on a playlist.
In the Groove by
Into the Groove, boy. You got to prove.
So if you're at the grill.
Yep.
And the songs are spinning and it's good times and you're having fun and you're chatting. What is the song that makes you like put down the spatula and tell everyone to hush because this is your perfect song for this barbecue?
Oh my gosh, I don't know. I need to think about that one.
I like to think that it's Madonna.
No, I don't think I picked Madonna for that one.
Okay. But, well, think about it.
Yeah, I'll think about it. I'll think about it. So we're going to hear more from Morning Edition in just a moment. KXE has a mission to build community throughout northern Minnesota. Our loyal audience supports the community organizations that support KAXE. Consider joining us in building community in northern Minnesota. Learn more. Email sponsor at KAXE.org. Thank you.
We receive support from North Homes Children and Family Services, providing compassionate mental health services to children and families at home, school, and in the community. More information at northhomes.org.
And we receive support from Lake Country Journal, a local lifestyle magazine sharing stories about places to go, things to do, and people to know in Lake Country. More at lakecountryjournal.com. Now more from Morning Edition.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm A. Martinez.
And I'm Leila Faudel. One piece of President Trump's tax and spending bill would make big cuts to the SNAP food assistance program. The Congressional Budget Office estimates almost 3 million people would lose SNAP benefits. So before the votes in the House overnight, we called up Linda Jones. She co-founded Alabama Childhood Food Solutions. She told Michelle Martin how many people there are in need.
We've had like a 30% increase from just last year with our children's bags. We're now doing like 2,600 kids a week with a backpack ministry.
And the backpack ministry, remind us what that is?
The backpack ministry is where we feed children that don't get enough food during the week at school, and we give them food for the weekends. And then our family size, where we give families groceries like 70 to 80 pounds every time they come in, that is increased from 600 to 1,200 families that we're feeding, and it's just growing by leaps and bounds.
Why do you think it's gone up so much so far?
Well, I think it's because of the food prices. You know, like eggs, $8 a dozen. Who can afford that? And milk so high. Everything was so high. We've had people to come in and said that, you know, they got food stamps even, but that doesn't give them anything but bread and milk. And by the time they get out of the grocery store, that's it. So that's where they come to us to get other food.
One of the things that this bill would do, especially with Medicaid and SNAP, it would now be linked to work requirements.
Yes, and I don't know how that's going to work because some of the people, granted, some of them could work, and I agree with that. Those that are capable of working should work. But some of them, you look at them and you think, man, they could go out and go to work. But once you start talking to them, it's a different story entirely.
It's my understanding that a lot of people who get Medicaid and or food stamps already work. Is that true?
Yes. Mm-hmm. I think so.
So tell me more about that. If they already work, like, what's the story? Like, why do they need this food help?
some of them that we feed come in and get food, and they said, you know, they like $1 or $2 to qualify for being on food stamps, or they've lost their food stamps because they move. We had some children in our backpack ministry where this young boy was getting food every week. He came in and asked the teacher if he could possibly get his bag early because they had no food in the house whatsoever. So come to find out, there was a dad that had 7 children whose wife took the youngest child and left him abandoned with the other children. And this man and his family were just hanging on by a thread. But we came in and we're giving them food now monthly to help him with his grocery bill at least.
Do you see waste, fraud, and abuse in the system from where you are?
From my standpoint, no. Mostly what we see are poor, poor people. We try to make every dollar we can count to be able to buy that food. We have an audit every year, and this year they came in and they said that we are 97% is what we use for all our food and stuff. Only 3% is used for other things.
Which is a very narrow margin. So I guess you're operating mostly on volunteers, right?
Yes. Yeah. We have over 900 volunteers to come in through our distribution center once a year.
That's Linda Jones. She's the co-founder, along with her husband, of Alabama Childhood Food Solutions, which, as you've just heard, feeds kids and everybody else who needs food in Central Alabama. Linda Jones, thank you so much for talking to us once again.
Thank you so much for having me.
The legal fight over ghost guns is heating up again. In March, the Supreme Court upheld restrictions on build-it-yourself gun kits from the Biden administration. Gun rights groups are hoping those restrictions will be swept away anyway. And as NPR's Martin Costi reports, they're looking to the Trump administration and the courts.
The kits are called ghost guns because when they first came out, manufacturers sold them as if they were just parts, no serial number, and untraceable. And you could assemble that gun without getting the usual background check. Bill Brooks chairs the Firearms Committee of the International Association of Chiefs of Police.
The people who make them oftentimes and put them on the street are putting them in the hands of people who are prohibited, putting them in the hands of convicted felons, as evidenced by the fact that so many now are showing up at crime scenes.
That's why the chiefs welcomed the Biden administration's rule in 2022, which required background checks and serial numbers for certain gun kits, and the subsequent Supreme Court decision in March.
It was good news that the court upheld the ATF regulation.
But that didn't end the matter. The ATF has told NPR that it's now reviewing the rule, along with other Biden-era gun regulations, under an order from President Trump. Alan Gottlieb of the Second Amendment Foundation says he expects the ATF will change the rule, making gun rights challenges to it, quote, moot.
We've urged the administration to act as quickly as possible. However, there's a lot on their plate, and I don't know how quickly it will happen, but we'd like it as soon as possible.
But others in the gun rights movement are not willing to wait for the administration. Cody Wilson is known for pioneering 3D printed guns. Now his company, Defense Distributed, sells the G80. It's a product he's careful not to call a gun.
You know, we're amping up production of this thing. What is this thing? You know, it's at least a kit with fixtures and unfinished components that you can ultimately build into a 9mm pistol, let's say.
He suspects that the Trump administration actually sympathizes with law enforcement and is quietly planning to maintain some version of the ghost gun rule. So in June, he filed a motion for a preliminary injunction to suspend it. The case is in the Fifth Circuit, which has been hostile to gun kit restrictions in the past.
I actually want there to be some law before this administration is over that the Second Amendment includes the right to build arms and not just keep them.
There are folks out there who want there to be no gun laws at all, and they see this as being the avenue to do it.
David Pacino with the Giffords Law Center to Prevent Gun Violence agrees that the status of ghost guns is still in play, in part because of legal moves like this one.
They are trying to leverage all of these interventions and legal challenges, and the idea is that if they can sell a gun in parts without it counting as a gun, there are no gun laws that apply at all. That's the end goal here.
Both sides are now watching to see just how hard the Trump Justice Department will fight to defend a ghost gun regulation that's already been upheld by the Supreme Court. Martin Costi, NPR News.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm A. Martinez.
And I'm Leila Faldin.
And you're listening to Morning Edition here on the Thursday morning show here on KAXE-KBXE.
Sounds weird, Thursday.
I know, it's hard to say. I'm Andrew DeZingle here with Heather Johnson.
Hey, good morning.
Good morning. And we were talking about getting our summer playlist ready, and then we somehow started talking about Louis Armstrong. And we were talking about the movie Paris Blues, and then we also heard from Scott Hall again. Joanne Woodward is who was married to Paul Newman. You know, that name was in the back of my head, and I wanted to say it, but I wasn't confident enough.
I have to look everyone up. I would have gotten it wrong. Yeah, so Paris Blues is on Tubi, right?
Yes.
And we both love Tubi because it's a free streaming app.
Yep, you don't need to sign in or anything.
Yeah, and they
you just watch it.
Oh, lots of classic movies and lots of squirrely stuff.
A lot
stuff.
Of foreign films, too.
Yeah. Oh, foreign films, too. Okay.
And Scott Hall also pointed out that the soundtrack was done by Duke Ellington. And yes, I remember that. It's a great soundtrack.
Oh, that's super cool. I've got to see it now because I haven't seen that one. We're also looking for your barbecue songs, like your greatest barbecue playlist songs?
Yeah, what would you want to hear at a summer barbecue, you know? So maybe you're playing bags over on the side while the hot dogs are grilling.
Yeah.
Maybe you're getting that potato salad ready
to put out on the table.
To put on the table.
So we got a couple of responses already. Louis Armstrong strutting with some barbecue. Of course, Bright Whites by Kishibashi.
We're going to hear in just a little bit.
Everyone would pick that one. And I said, everybody eats when they come to my house, which is Cab Calloway. So woohoo for me. We also heard just now from AJ in Bemidji, who says, a warm summer day around the grill had to include some Steely Dan for me. When I was a kid, I'd often hear it coming from the garage in the summer as my dad would be blasting it from his 8-track while working on some project or another. I'd also throw Howard Jones on an upbeat grilling playlist. Nobody can help singing along to the chorus of Things Can Only Get Better, right? I don't know that song.
I don't know it either.
Oh. How about what Steely Dan song do you think?
Yeah, what Steely Dan song?
So I like to change those Steely Dan lyrics a little bit and say, take your big black cow and get out of here.
What about, I can't think of anything funny.
That's okay. That's okay. Steely Dan is great, though. I really enjoy that band in general.
Are you grilling in the years? Are you grilling up those dogs?
Maybe. It might need a little work. Oh, we also heard from Brandon, who says, barbecue tunes, Coconuts by Widespread Panic.
Oh, I don't know if I know that one.
I don't know if I do either, but I feel like, you know, my head for titles is not super great. So, like, maybe if I heard it, I might know it. Possibly.
Possibly.
You seem skeptical. You're like, you would not know that song if you heard it.
I don't know.
Come on.
You also heard from Mary from Cass Lake wishing us a good morning. Good morning, Mary.
Hey, Mary, what are you doing up so early? You get to sleep in this time of year.
So we want to hear your tune recommendations for our summer barbecue playlist. Text us at 218-326-1234. And yeah, let's keep the groove rolling. So I'm going to play this Kishibashi song that you refuse to have even pretended to have heard of.
I will next time.
I think you're going to dig this tune. So we'll hear what you think in just a moment. Here it is, Kishibashi with Bright Whites.
anxious for you to see me to see. Murder and colonies, land without rivers, raging in the middle of some sad destiny.
And that was Kishibashi with Bright Whites. What'd you think, Heather?
I loved it.
Yay!
Definitely have never heard it before, and I'm going to check it out in the CD library maybe later.
Ooh, nice.
Yeah, good stuff.
That's Heather Johnson. I'm Andrew DeZingo. We're your Thursday morning show crew for the day, and we are talking about summer barbecue playlists. What would you put on there? And that was my pick for the first song. My choice here on, and we want to hear from you. Text us at 218-326-1234. What should be on our summer barbecue playlist?
Yeah, and we heard from Mary. I was teasing Mary that she shouldn't be up so early because it's her off season, and she should be sleeping in, and she let me know that she has been. So that's great to hear. And also, she wanted to throw Pablo a good morning. So good morning, Pablo, from Mary.
Good morning. We received support from Dragonfly Coffee, located in Central Square Mall in Grand Rapids, featuring a scratch bakery and offering espresso, bubble tea, and more. Empowering inclusion and community through employment. Special orders available and more at drinkdragonfly.com.
Support for KAXE comes from Grand Itasca Clinic and Hospital, home to an experienced OBGYN team that provides comprehensive women's health services, including maternity and advanced gynecology care, all in Grand Rapids. Learn more at granditasca.org.
And this is 91.7 KAXE.